Hello and what is up, farewell listeners. Hope everyone is having a great day. Today is a roundtable. We usually don't do intros for roundtable, but I wanted to give some context for today's episode because part of what we do is we react to last Thursday's episode, which was a conversation with Evelyn Triboli, who's a nutritionist and dietitian, about intuitive eating. And intuitive eating, most generally, is the idea of honoring your body's hunger by eating what you want, when you want it, not labeling foods as good or bad, so not moralizing foods. And there's a specific clip that we react to in today's roundtable, so I want to play that clip so you have the clip and the context before we launch into our roundtable discussion. Here's the clip.
I think people really underestimate the impact of primal hunger. And that is, let's say you go too long without eating. And when you finally have a chance to eat, it feels like a nonstop food fest. And that's actually an example of your body working. It's no different than if you're going underwater because a big wave comes and you hold your breath. Another set comes, so you got to really hold your breath, and you finally come up for air and you're gasping and you inhale that air. And no one says, oh my God, you have lots of control breathing. Oh, you're addicted to air. And we need to look at food that same way, that when we go into extreme cases where you went too long without eating or not enough, there's a compensatory effect that will end up happening, which we call primal hunger.
Okay, so that's the clip. Now we will jump into today's roundtable. Hope you enjoy. I think we're going to do our first ever podcast postmortem, because last week we featured an interview with Evelyn Triboli, who is a registered nutritionist and dietitian and one of the co-founders of Intuitive Eating. And a lot has been said on this podcast in the past about nutrition and diet and eating, which I was very aware of and tried to get ahead of in the intro a little bit, but there were some strong feelings about the episode. And so I want to cede the floor to you guys to talk about how you felt about that episode.
I think that Evelyn was probably our smartest and, at the very least, our best communicating guest to date. So I absolutely loved the episode and listening to her argue for her thesis. And she's also the guest that I probably have disagreed most strongly with in the history of this podcast. So those are my initial reactions to the pod. And my disagreement is really on a foundational principle of intuitive eating that Evelyn argued for. And she used the metaphor of air and essentially said that food is like air and that we cannot live without air and we cannot live without food. And I think that where that metaphor to me falls short is that the introduction of ultra processed food would essentially be like if somebody made air that is a lot more enticing than the air that we're used to breathing. And that the more of it we breathe, the more of it we want. And that our bodies get so used to breathing that air that eventually we start hyperventilating. And the only way to feel normal is to continue hyperventilating. And based on the research that I've seen coming more in the public health world, that is essentially the problem with ultra-processed foods. So I think this notion that Evelyn discussed of intuitive eating and listening to our bodies and not having good or bad foods and not withholding any kinds of foods from ourselves because we are programmed to eat just like we are programmed to breathe air. I think that is all true and very valid, but that's for actual food. That's not for ultra processed food. So what I would say is that for most people, certainly everyone that I have ever worked with, having some kind of constraints, and we talked about this in a prior episode as well, on the types of foods that you just never eat, or that maybe you only eat once a week or once a month. These tend to be the ultra processed foods, right? The foods that, again, are meant to leave us unfull, unsatiated, and wanting more. Once you have that constraint, then within the universe of good whole foods, yes, I could not agree more with Evelyn. Intuitive eating makes sense. but I do not think intuitive eating makes sense for ice cream or Skittles. And you push back on her in the interview, and she kept saying that, you know, if all you did was eat ice cream, eventually you'd probably feel kind of crappy. But I just don't think that's true. I mean, you look at the population and you look at rates of overweight and obesity, and if it was making us feel crappy, then we wouldn't have 66% of the population that is struggling with overweight and obesity. And not all these people are involved in diet culture. They're in a food environment that is full with ultra processed food. So again, I come back to it. If you can breathe this air, or you can breathe air that just is the best air, and man, it just feels so good as you're breathing it. And then you just want more, and your body gets so used to it that normal air starts to be boring. Well, which air are you going to choose? And that's the evolutionary mismatch in a nutshell, that we evolved to eat very intuitively. If we're eating whole grains and lean proteins and fruits and vegetables and potatoes, but we did not evolve to eat intuitively if we're eating Skittles, ice cream, and chicken nuggets.
I took her air analogies in a slightly different way. Not saying I necessarily agree with her, but I understood it to be about this very, about ultra processed foods, in the sense that she was saying, because the thing that gets levied a lot at the criticism that gets levied a lot in intuitive eating is exactly what you're saying, which is if you can intuitive eating, what Evelyn would say, I think, is that it's about honoring your hunger. So that means no foods are off limits. There's no quote unquote good foods. There's no quote unquote bad foods. And you eat when you're hungry and you eat until you're full, but not past that point. And the criticism that gets levied most commonly is like, well, then people are just going to eat Oreos and ice cream and candy and Popeyes and fast food all the time. And I thought her air point was basically like, if you've been underwater forever, denying yourself these things because they're bad, and then you come up, you're going to be sucking down a lot of air because there's a compensatory effect. But then once you get enough air back in, you will regulate and you won't be sucking down all this air because you no longer will be following a deprivation binge model. Now, I'm not saying I agree with that necessarily, but that was how I took her point. And I don't know. I think it's complicated. I think I lean more towards agreeing with you, Brad. And everyone's situation is very different. So I want to acknowledge that, like, I have a very specific situation and I'm not trying to project my experience to be everyone's. But like, if I do eat, as I've had days where I've had a week where I've had ice cream every day, and like the eighth day, I'm like, I can't have ice cream anymore. And again, I know I'm just N of one. I do think the body does self-regulate in some way. Now, granted, I've been very fortunate to know what it feels like to feel good. And I feel like a lot of people in this country don't feel good all the time and don't even necessarily know what it feels like to feel good and eat well. And so they might just be in, like, not listen to that self-regulatory mechanism for all sorts of reasons. They might be in chronic pain. They may not have access to healthy foods. They might live in a food desert. But I think I am overall closer to agreeing with you, but I think I am a little bit more, like, I think her argument carries a little bit more water with me than it sounds like it does with you.
Well, you also, on the same episode, Clay, if I'm not mistaken, said that you essentially think about what you just ate or what you are going to eat most waking hours during the day.
Yeah.
So you have focus on food and how it makes you feel. And because of that, on the eighth day of eating ice cream, you're probably starting to freak out a little bit that maybe this isn't so good for me. And you're freaking out. You're feeling gross. You start to tell yourself that you're going to feel gross and you start to feel gross. That's its own kind of constraint. Like putting the energy and effort on food. And the last thing I'll say, and I know Steve's itching to get in here, is there are countless studies of various mammals where, you know, you essentially feed them ultra processed foods and they just don't stop. And these aren't animals that have like the ability to understand what diet culture is or to like restrict themselves. These are animals without big prefrontal cortices like we have. And they all essentially will eat themselves to death if you feed them ultra processed foods. So I just think that Evelyn discounts the power of the food scientist and the food engineers. And again, I think the proof is in the pudding. I don't think that 200 plus million Americans are involved in diet culture. I think 200 plus million Americans are living in a shitty food environment.
Steve's going to explode if he doesn't talk.
All right. Well, first off, all I'm saying is if we feed Hazley, our 11-month-old daughter, her little freeze-dried yogurt treats first, it would, that's all she'd eat. So, you know, no peas, carrots, forget that. Just the little treats that you can buy because they have like, you know, 1 gram of sugar in them or whatever it is that just... So anyways, the point being, I think like Brad, there's a little of that. But I think if we zoom out a little bit and understand this through what researchers call interoception, which is basically a fancy word for reading our internal signals. I talked about it in Do Hard Things. Brad's talked about it before. But it's basically, can we read our internal signals? And what most of the research shows is that we're surprisingly bad at reading our internal signals. And we could look at this from an athletic standpoint, and I could say, great, Clay, you go run. And if you're a novice, when you first got into running, you could not distinguish between maybe pain, fatigue, and an injury because it all feels the freaking same. So what happens, you keep training and then you get hurt and you're like, oh my God, I got hurt. And your coach is like, Clay, why didn't you listen when that initially started weeks ago and we could have backed off and you would have been okay. But now you're, you know, tore muscle or have a stress fracture or whatever have you. Why? Because you're not good at reading those signals initially. And what research shows us is that yes, if we pay attention, if we hone that skill over time, we'll get better at reading that signal. But even then, like some of us are just kind of better and some of us aren't. In the research world, they often test this by, can you guess without putting your hand on your heart or a hand on your pulse, how fast your heart is beating? And what that gives us the idea is, again, can I listen to my body? And again, surprisingly, most of us are really bad at this. To use another example, I think hunger is a lot like fatigue. Because we think hunger in society and we think, oh, this is simple. Like, am I full or not? Same with fatigue. Am I tired or not? But when we peel back the layer, it's a hell of a lot more complex than that. And anybody who has done any sort of task to fatigue, endurance, whatever have you, can tell you that. Because along the way, you get all of these crazy signals. Some telling you that, like, hey, you're really tired. You should slow down. But as if you keep going, you find out, no, that was just fake, right? That was just my body freaking out. That was my body convincing me to try and step in a hole because like it just didn't have confidence that I could go through it. Then you hit a level of fatigue that maybe is completely differently, that you feel in your muscles instead of your chest and your breathing. And maybe you can't run through that. You have to have a different strategy. And the point is, when we look at fatigue, it's all of this mixture of signals from your muscles, from your breathing, from the acid-base, you know, distribution in your body, all sorts of things kind of coming together and saying, like, am I tired or not? And I think, again, I'm not an expert on this, but if we look at hunger in society, it's a similar complex issue. It's not straightforward. And again, I'm pulling from grad school a long time ago, but I remember nutrition, you looked at, not only do you have hormonal indicators of hunger, but you also have like stretch receptor indicators of hunger in the stomach and all of that stuff. And those kind of combine together and tell you, am I full or not? But just like fatigue, it's not an accurate one-on-one. In actuality, with hunger, there's often a delayed effect, right? So when we're full, we don't know until, you know, 10, 20 minutes later, whatever it is. Again, don't quote me on that. I haven't looked at the research on the exact timing, but there is delayed effect. So I think all of these come into play when we look at intuitive eating, not saying that it's not real, not saying that we shouldn't train ourselves up to, you know, be able to read these signals, but that it's just like fatigue in the sense that we've got to learn to read the signals. But also, if we get obsessed with reading the signals, then that backfires. Because what happens if I'm on a run and I'm like, okay, I'm going to listen to my body. I'm going to pay attention to my muscle and feel the first time it feels the pain. Well, all I'm doing is telling my brain, like, be hyper responsive to this signal. You do the same with eating. Be hyper responsive to the signal. And then you're like, you know, focused so much on the eating, your brain like alters its perception of what's going on. So I think it's kind of like, you know, I always use the running analogies, but I think this one is a good one, is that we need to train to listen to our body. But at the same time, we have to train to understand that some of those signals are going to be false, and we've got to just let it float on by. And I think this is where Brad gets at, and I'm more in agreement with him, is that we have to understand the environment is rigged against us. While also at the same time understanding that, like, yeah, if we learn to read our signals, we're going to be in a slightly better state. But sometimes those signals are going to be off, and we better have some backup plan or constraints or something like that to prevent us from hitting the panic button when we don't need to.
Yeah. And to make it like really clear with an example, I was jotting this down while you were talking, Steve. If I'm having a turkey sandwich or carrots and hummus or an apple or salmon and brown rice, my signals are really good and I can intuitively eat. Like, I will stop when I'm full and I will not feel gross or sick the next day. I cannot do that with sausage, bacon, and onion pizza. I will just eat and eat and eat. And after three pieces, I'm starving, just as hungry as I was after the first. But I know that that is a false hunger signal. Like, there's no way I can actually still be starving. I just had three monstrous pieces of pizza. But the fat, the sodium, like, that pizza is made to make me want to continue to eat it. And I just find that it is impossible that I am a good intuitive eater with a turkey sandwich, but a bad intuitive eater with pizza, and that somehow that's on me. That's not the difference between pizza and a turkey sandwich.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I agree with that. And I think the fatigue example is a really good one. And
yeah.
And if this is happening to, and like, I am similar, I actually can't stop eating anything. Like, I can't, I'm not any better with turkey than I am with Oreos. I overeat in every scenario, but I do think that is illustrative in and of itself, because I have so many privileges in my life that allow me to be connected to my body and have access to good food. And if I'm still disconnected and have false hunger signals, I think there are probably a lot of people who don't have these privileges who are like definitely disconnected from their body. And I think in that sense, it makes me think intuitive eating, there's something about intuitive eating that appeals to me. And from a sense of like, it's nice to think that we wouldn't have to have good and bad foods. But I think, like anything, it's maybe a little, or like a lot of things in our society, it's a little too idealistic, and it doesn't take into account all of the sort of lack of social and societal support and nets and infrastructure that would be necessary in order to, like, for people to have the proper, be in the proper place to intuitive eat. Right.
Yeah. Intuitive Instagram or intuitive Twitter?
That's a good. Yeah. I was thinking the same thing. Well, no, that's why I delete it.
Right.
Let me give.
But
one
there's
more.
Something you could do. You could turn off notifications. You can, yeah. Like, there are some ways you can.
But that's the same thing as having food constraints. That's exactly what I'm saying. Yeah. Like, it's not to say that you should shun pizza. You know, we don't shun social media.
Yeah.
But if I didn't have some constraints, it would ruin my brain. And it's ruined so many people's brains because they don't have constraints, just like our ultra processed food environment is like deteriorated people's bodies. It's no different.
Yeah. Yeah. And I agree with that. And I think fundamentally, I believe that this stuff should never fall, whether you're talking about addictive engineering in technology or you're talking about addictive engineering in food. I don't think this stuff should fall on the individual. I think the thing that appeals to me about intuitive eating and tying it to my own personal experience is that, like, the deprivation binge model and moralizing foods that I have really struggled with, because I clearly, as people can hear, I can't eat like a couple bites of ice cream. You know, I have to have the whole pint. And I think and that's a little defeatist. I'm talking not very with a growth mindset there, but like that is because I've grown up being like, this food's bad, this food is good. And I think that deprivation binge mindset is something that I've really struggled with. And so if you get rid of that, intuitive eating does try to get rid of it. I think that appeals to me, but it's one small thing. And I think what we're talking about is a much larger societal thing.
Yeah, I agree. I think the labeling food, we've talked about this before, but like labels assign meaning. So if you say something is bad, then it causes that guilt with it. And sometimes, as the example I like to use, the elite Kenyan runners eat a dump truck full of sugar. Is that bad for them? No, because they're probably running 120 miles a week, and that sugar is what needs to fuel them. For if you're not running 120 miles a week, maybe not.
Okay, guys, on to the second topic of today. Since we just spent the first segment responding to a clip, I thought we could also do that in the second segment of the show. So I'm going to play a clip now that is from the media organization Big Think. Great company. Love what they do. And this is the actor, writer, director, Jesse Eisenberg talking.
When I think about like the kind of motivating factors for me, you know, it's effort and, you know, talent and creativity and all that stuff. But I cannot underestimate how often I'm just driven by anxiety and fear.
You and I are both very self-hating.
A lot of the things that motivate me are like kind of negative motivators. Misery, self-consciousness, self-hatred, and a lot of fear. I worry all the time that my last job is going to be the final one I'll ever have in my life. But, you know, when I meet people in other fields who have kind of forged their own paths, they have the exact same story. And it just occurred to me that this is kind of what, like, great people are motivated by. They're amazing at their job, they're creative, they think outside the box, but they're also worried that the next time is not going to go well. Once you're able to kind of reframe that anxiety as fuel, as motivation, as care, you worry less and are motivated more.
So that was Jesse Eisenberg. People who are not familiar with Jesse Eisenberg, he's an actor. He's also a writer and I believe a director. He's best known for playing Mark Zuckerberg in The Social Network. That clip was from a website called Big Think. What I thought was interesting was that we talk a lot about not using sort of negative motivators to be motivated. He talks a lot about his fear and anxiety using that. But I thought the way he characterized it was interesting. He said that great people are all motivated by the fear the next time isn't going to go well. And partly that rings true to me, but I think we've also had discussions where we talk a lot about people who are like securely attached to their talent, not insecurely attached. And so that, I thought there was an interesting tension there. And I'm just curious what jumped out to you guys about that clip or how you'd react to that idea.
My reaction is that motivation is a really complex and complicated topic that we often simplify. And I think when we look at it, when we talk about, as we have often, like intrinsic versus extrinsic, positive motivation versus negative, everybody has all of them. Everybody has all of them, right? But I think what the research tends to show is that more often than not, if we tip that extrinsic, or in this case, we tip that fear to where it's overwhelming or overwhelmingly coming from an insecure place, it tends to lead to negative outcomes for most. Now, I say for most because there are the Michael Jordans of the world who use that kind of like fear and disrespect to fuel things. But I think that also came out in other aspects of his life away from the basketball court, where he was highly successful on the court, but maybe not the best general manager, you know, or whatever he was, you know, owner of basketball team. And other things. So I think when we look at stuff like that, I think it's easy and it plays well to be like, the best have like, you know, fear is the motivator. But I just think that's way too simplistic. What I would counter with is that we all have insecurities. Those insecurities can either hamper us or we can kind of turn them into fuel. But if those insecurities are only fuel, meaning they're coming from a unstable platform, we're probably going to fall apart. If they're coming from a stable platform, meaning that, like, yeah, we're a little worried that our next book or project might be our last, but we're secure in our ability to work. We're secure in our identity around things and don't see it as like, this is going to be the disaster, the end of me, if I don't get this movie, project, book successful, then we'll be okay. But that's kind of how I see it, I guess.
I think there's a difference in catastrophic fear of failure versus wanting the next thing to be as good or better than the last. I will have some fear for my next book that it won't do as well as the previous ones, but I'll have no fear that the outcome of that next book will determine my career or my life, because it won't. And I just think, like, that's how to look at it. And then the other thing that Jesse said that I think makes a lot of sense is if you can turn that fear, I think he said, into caring, then it works in your favor. And I think there's a lot to unpack there, but in brief, there's some research that shows that if we can label what we might experience as anxiety as excitement instead, we tend to perform better. So I think if you can take what you might say as fear, and instead of saying I'm scared, say I care, that mindset shift actually goes a long way. And then the things that we care about are going to be the things that we are fearful won't go well, because we want to do our best. We want things to go our way, especially when we care. So I think, like, little shifts in framing can go a long way. You know, there's a big difference between saying I'm scared I'm going to lose this next game, or I'm scared I'm not going to get the promotion, versus I care about winning and I care about getting the promotion.
I think that's a good reframing. I do think you need a little bit of fear, insecurity. I guess you could just reframe it as care. But if you don't have something, like, I would argue that you guys both saying, you know, you're going to be slightly worried about your next book, that fear provides a motivation in a way. Where if you were just 100% secure, you probably wouldn't write the book. Or, I mean, you might disagree with this. I would say maybe you wouldn't write the book, or you wouldn't write it as well as you're going to write it, because there isn't that little voice that's like, this needs to be good, this needs to be good. But maybe disagree.
No, I think you're right. But I would say that I would relabel that, as Brad said, from fear to care. Like, I don't see it as a fear. I think it's just because I care about the thing. And I think if you look at anything that I do, like that little voice of like, is this going to be good enough? Am I going to succeed or whatever? That's like part of being human for things you care about. For things, if you don't add that voice, to me, it just simply means that you don't care about that pursuit that much. And that's okay, because there's a lot of pursuits that I do or things that I do in my life that I don't have that voice. I mean, Brad can tell you, where I'm just like, just send this off into the world. Who gives a shit? But that's mostly because it's like something that doesn't have some importance to me. So I tend to think of it less as like a fear of like failure and more of like, this matters to me and I put a lot of work into it and I want it to do well. And of course there's that worry that it won't do well. But I think the key is that, you know, for a book, like if it doesn't sell as many copies, there's still that security knowing like, hey, this was my best effort. This was good work and that's okay. And if you don't have that, this is going to be okay, I think that's where you run into big problems.
Mm. Yeah, I do think the one counter to this comes maybe in very specific athletic contexts. And that is like, I'm thinking of if you go to a powerlifting meet and you have a goal of hitting 550 pounds on your deadlift, and you get three attempts, right? And you hit it on your second attempt. Well, then the third attempt, you get to do what I call like a fuck it, we're playing with the house's money attempt. And there is no fear of missing or anything. And I think oftentimes athletes perform really well in those situations. It's not a fuck it, I'm gonna lose. It's fuck it, I've already won. And I do wonder like how we can create more of that outside of sport. Cause it's obviously not just powerlifting. We saw this in the Sochi games. I'm forgetting his name, but there was a bobsled athlete who had like really, really, really struggled and then like finally put together the race that he thought like he was worthy of. And then after that, in the rest of his runs, he just crushed. Like, it just got better and better and better. And he said, like, once I hit my mark, I was just having fun. And like, that freedom is something that that I do think when we have it, we should channel it. And I do wonder, like, in a book launch, what does it take for us to get to the point where it's purely just having fun? Because we do have fun, but there's that element of fear versus, like, you know, the sorry for swearing, I hope your kids aren't listening, but the like, fuck it, let's have fun and perform from that place.
I mean, I actually, you know, surveyed, gosh, probably 100 performers across sports business and asked them to think of their best performance, whatever that meant to them. And then their like emotional state around it. And of those 100-ish, like there were very few who said like, oh, I was afraid or fearful of losing or whatever. They were just like, to Brad's, you know, point, summarizing, like, they were just having fun. They're like, everything's clicking. Like, I wasn't worried about losing or what have you. I was just in it and cruising. And I think if I look at my best races, you know, that's how it was. You know, did I run some where I was afraid of? Absolutely. And sometimes I ran okay. But my best competitions were almost always, you know, I was kind of carefree to a degree. Like, I cared, but it didn't feel that like overwhelming burden. And I think sometimes, especially in life, we don't experience it that often. So we kind of discount it and we say, hey, most of the time the fear is there. So I'm just going to learn how to still perform well in this. But in those small moments where you're playing with house money, it's, you know, it's easy.
Yeah. I think we're talking about play, like actual genuine playfulness and playing open versus playing scared, right? I think you see that a lot in sports, especially when a team gets a lead, they start to play scared and then they lose versus teams that are keep their foot on the gas. They're like, we got a lead. We're going to see what we do this. Then they can really run away with the game. And the other thing that jumps out to me, connecting it back to other conversations we've had, is it's also like that open play is fueled by curiosity, right? We've heard people on this podcast before. I'm thinking specifically of Damian Warner, also Courtney DeWalter. Like, we invoke them a lot, but both of them talked about like, I'm going to go out there and see what happens today and be curious. And so it's not, you're not like coming at it from like, I don't want to lose or being scared of lose. You're just going out there to have an experience and see what happens. Third topic of interest today. We have a newsletter going out. We're recording this on a Tuesday. It'll be out on Thursday when you guys hear this episode. And we had a newsletter go out last week that Steve wrote, one by Brad today. And they're on a very similar theme. I'm going to let you explain, Brad, since you have the newsletter going out this week, but I just thought it might be worth talking about since this is something that has come up 2 weeks in a row now.
All right. Well, if you read the newsletter today, this is going to be a recap. If you haven't, I'll give you the quick audio cliff notes. Last week, Apple unveiled a new commercial for the next generation iPad, which is really, really thin. And that's the selling point. And the commercial, if you haven't seen it, just shows a compressor essentially squashing guitars, bobbleheads, footballs, computers, saxophones, all of these things, material things, squashing, 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 compressing, blowing them up, busting them. And then at the end, the compressor opens up the littlest bit and you see this razor thin iPad. And Apple unveiled this commercial at a big advertising conference, and they thought that it was going to be, you know, they're known for their historic commercials. And the reaction was just horrible. Like, not a single person liked this commercial, to the point where Apple apologized and they decided that this commercial that they invested so heavily in making, they're not actually going to run it on TV. Somebody on the internet named Riza tweeted, "Hey, Apple, I think I can fix this for you." And he showed the commercial, but ran it in reverse. So instead of all the instruments in sports objects and objects of creativity being squashed, it starts with a razor thin iPad and then it opens up to all those things. And I don't know about you all, but I certainly prefer the second version. And I think that the reason that people had such a viscerally negative reaction to the first version is because it essentially shows this new piece of technology squashing and flattening so much of what makes us human. The ability to create, the ability to play sports and to feel things, as Steve wrote about in the newsletter last week, and essentially all the things that make us human. And the really strikingly simple example that I use in the newsletter is that if AI gets to a point, and it will, where you can press three buttons and compose a Grammy Award level song, would you feel fulfilled? Would you be really proud? Would you be like, oh, that was a great day. I composed a Grammy Award song. No, you hit three buttons on AI. But if you actually did the work to write a song, even if it wasn't half as good, you'd feel a lot more satisfied. And I think that as technology continues to improve, we are going to have to protect our humanity. And I think that we can define our humanity as our ability to think for ourselves, to feel things, and to genuinely connect with others. And technology is very quickly encroaching on all of those things. Technology is great and it's a phenomenal tool, but it's a phenomenal tool insofar that it opens up our humanity and gives us more opportunities to express it, not squashes it.
I think the summary is we need to double down on doing real things in the real world with real people. And as we go into this kind of AI tech world, it's not to, as Brad said, put it down. But I think we have to look at, we have these fundamental physiological, psychological needs that we've evolved for millennia to have. And a couple of those, as Brad said, is to connect and to feel an experience. And as I talked about in the previous newsletter, Brad alluded to, is it was all about feeling alive. And I think why we're seeing a proliferation, and Brad talked about this in this week's newsletter, of like physical fitness challenges, or over the last decade or two, an increase in marathons and ultra marathons and obstacle races and triathlons and just things that make us feel something. I think there's a reason for that, because as we go increasingly virtual, we're going increasingly to what I'd call like cheap feelings or experiences, or maybe superficial or simulated experiences. And the analogy I would use is it's like taking the drug instead of feeling the exercise endorphin high. And sure, the drug like feels good, but it isn't fulfilling and satisfying and a net positive. It's a net negative because it's, again, not fulfilling, not satisfying, didn't come from any work, etc. It's tied to the needle or pill you're taking. Well, if you go out and get that runner's high or that experience of creating something or doing a creative act, it's tied to the doing the thing. And I think that makes it a deep or lasting experience, which expands our perspective. It expands our human experience instead of constricting us. And I think the reason we, Brad and I, have latched onto this, other people have talked about it, is because, you know, the more time we spend addicted to our apps, the more time we spend online, we're essentially, you know, to tie it back to the eating thing, we're numbing ourselves to sensations and experiences. And the way to counter that numbness is to do real things in the real world.
I want to add one other point here, Clay, because in addition to doing real things in the real world and the flattening of what makes us human in the real world, I think a lot of these technologies are also flattening the internet. And I know our guest next week, Kyle Chayka, has a lot to say on this. He wrote a book on this. So I won't go too deep into it because I'm not the expert he is. But something that I've noticed is that on all the social media apps, increasingly, there are just posts that are so clearly written by artificial intelligence or written by humans that are essentially becoming like artificial intelligence, that are just flowery, inspirational bullshit. There are so many newsletters now that are 20 ways to change your life in 20 days, twice a week. Well, you know, there's only so many ways that you can change your life. And it's very hard to change your life every Tuesday and Friday, if I'm being totally honest. But the algorithm, like, it's flattened the internet to the things that go viral, to like those superficial cheap hits. And back to where we started, intuitive eating, those things feel good for a while, but eventually, like, we don't like to consume that kind of stuff, and we certainly don't like to produce it. So I think in addition to doing real things on the real world, I think that something is going to be happening on the internet, and we at The Growth Equation are very aware of this, and we're doing everything we can to get ahead of this, where, like, the internet as we know it is likely going to become a flattened, monolithic experience of flowery bullshit. But there's going to be opportunities for cool niche communities. And in a way, you'll have Internet 3.0, which will be the flattened, boring internet. And then hopefully you'll have like a return to Internet 1.0 with blogs and servers and cool communities of people that are like doing really interesting things, but will never go super big or super mainstream. And in a way, you've kind of seen this with newsletters. Like, there are so many great newsletters now that are just better than the endemic big publications, because the endemic big publications have flattened to all run the same kind of stories. And I'm speaking in broad strokes because many big publications do great work, but like, there's going to be an opportunity for niches. So just like there's niches in the real world to go do a cool physical challenge, as Steve said, do real things with real people in the real world. I think on the internet, there's going to be a movement of like cool, small subculture communities that aren't so focused on the monolithic flattening of everything.
Yeah, for me, the thing that I agree, I think the thing that stands out to me that sort of ties these two things together is identity in some ways. Like, if you don't do the hard work that brings meaning and go through the discomfort of working towards something, you kind of don't learn who you are. And on the internet, if you just accept whatever the algorithm serves to you, whatever homogenized mass the algorithm has decided is the thing that is tailor-made to keep you engaged and stimulated so you don't get off the app, then you don't do any of the hard work of learning out what your actual taste is and discerning what you actually like. And so it's sort of like that is a loss of identity too. Yeah.
The way I like to frame that, Clay, is if we are living in a middle school lunchroom, meaning we are all searching for identity, only our middle school lunchroom isn't like 100 people, it's millions. So it's rigged against us. But we get to choose, do we go try and sit at the table to fit in and just like forget who we are and just like try and be with the cool kids, like serving up their ChatGPT, like superficial bullshit that doesn't mean anything? Or do we go explore and find our niche? Do we go try the band or the cross country team or the basketball team or the, you know, theater arts or whatever have you, and do the experience to see who we are by performing and doing real things? And I think that's kind of where we're at, both in the real world and on the internet. And we have a choice. Do we fit in, or do we find like actual belonging, which is figuring out who we are and the people who we want to be around?
I think that's a wonderful place to end. We got a lot in today. Intuitive eating, Jesse Eisenberg, motivation, doing real things in the real world. We, I think I speak for all of us, can say that we're happy that you guys have found us, our little corner of the internet. So thank you for listening. Please invite more people in who you think will like this. Send them the podcast, send them one of the newsletters. Thank you always for listening. And we'll be back on Monday with another Coach Up, and then again next Thursday with the interview with Kyle. So please stay tuned for that. If you don't want to miss it, just go ahead and subscribe. Maybe leave a 5-star review. Until next week, when we talk to you again, as always, farewell.